So then I welcome you all to this three-part class on, for our discussion about dying. And how I see this class, a series, is my hope for it, in a sense, was primarily for it to be informative. In the past, I've done workshops kind of thing on the topic of death and dying. They were more about practicing with the topic or kind of working with it, with our own relationship to it and our attitudes towards it, and more of a practice way. And we'll do some of that in a couple of Fridays from now. It's in the newsletter, the particular Friday it is, but maybe a week from Friday. We have a kind of a one-day retreat from 9:30 to 3:30 that the topic will be death and dying. And I realize a lot of people can't come on Friday, but that's the way it worked out for us to do. And that'll be more practice-focused. And the reason why I wanted to do something that was more information or informative, information-focused here, is, as some people said earlier, there's a lot of people now on the peninsula connected to our community who have been Buddhist practitioners for a long time, where the mindfulness practice, the Buddhist practice, is very central to how they orient their lives. And when you come to the issue of death and dying, they would like to somehow have the process of dying, the process of taking care of other people dying, informed by their spiritual affiliation or religious connection to Buddhism. What does it mean? What is it like to die as a Buddhist? Or what are the resources as a Buddhist? What are the understandings? What are the practices that kind of fit in harmony with what my practice has been? I've been now to a number of people in our Sangha who's with them as they're dying, and done memorial service for people. And and it's all been, maybe as it should be. But as a person who comes in, kind of in the capacity of a minister, kind of someone who's a meditation teacher, comes in to offer spiritual counseling and to offer the memorial service, the funerals and stuff that happens, the tending of the body. I often find myself in a situation where I don't want to impose a particular Buddhist view on people, and because often it's not that appropriate, people have their own idea of what they want to see happen. But people at the same time are interested in knowing what a Buddhist view is, and it seems awkward for me to kind of present too much. Their loved one has just died, and I'm going to go through the list and see, this is what you can do as a Buddhist. It just somehow doesn't seem appropriate for me, and I'm more kind of into it, the relationship and what needs to be said and done. And we come up with something that seems appropriate. But I thought it would be very helpful to kind of put together a class, maybe a manual, where a lot of these issues, a lot of the possibilities are laid out. So people can study that and look at that. And so it isn't coming from me. It's just like this is a resource that's available, and people can craft it and use what part of it is helpful for them. So in the Buddhist tradition, there's a very strong emphasis on being mindful and being doing things consciously, mindfully. And certainly there's a very important emphasis on being mindful as we die, to be mindful of the process of dying as much as we can. But in that spirit, there's also a place for being considered, reflective, conscientious about this very important transition in our life that is called death. And to prepare for it, not just simply to kind of wait until that time comes and just come with, take it as it is, but to actually spend some time preparing for it and understanding a little bit the process and becoming more conscious of that and making more part of one's life that this is really a possibility. I know there's lots of people who know in theory they're going to die, but, it's later, sometime later. And sometimes it comes quite a surprise that later is today. So to be more conscious and aware of it is a very important part of the Buddhist tradition. It's also considered to be a very important spiritual practice in Buddhism to do mindfulness meditation, do reflection practices on death. In the Theravada tradition that we're part of, there are classically considered to be 40 meditation topics. And of those 40, there are two which are said to be universally useful to everybody in all situations. And one of them is the meditation practice on loving kindness. And the other is the practice of mindfulness or reflection on death. In the one famous passage, the Buddha said, just as the elephant footprint is the biggest footprint in the jungle, so the most important meditation to do or reflection to do is that of reflection on death. And you find many Buddhists in the Theravadan world who spend time, very concentrated time, doing meditation practices on death and dying, reflecting on it, doing various practices on that topic. Especially among the monastic community in Asia, the monks and nuns will often go spend time with a corpse, usually someone they don't know, but sometimes someone they know, in order to do this contemplation of death and dying, to contemplate that at some point they'll be like this, and to really look kind of death straight in the face. When I was in, a sophomore in college, I took a drawing class, and somewhere in the halfway through the quarter, our teacher took us to the university's anatomy lab to draw a corpse that was there. And we went two sessions for 3 hours each. And the first session, I drew the fellow's foot. And by the time I came back for the next session, I realized I did that because that was about as far as away I could get from facing this issue, by drawing his foot. So the next time I went, I drew his face, thinking that kind of would really look at it directly and see it directly. And it was a little bit of a shock to go to the anatomy lab because we showed up kind of quite innocent and I wasn't expecting to do this. And I hadn't had much experience with dead bodies before that. And the teacher said he wanted to do it because everybody's drawings became a lot stronger after that experience, spending that week in those two sessions in the anatomy lab. And we showed up and the technician said, there was this body, perfectly good body laying there on the table, and he said, what part of the body would you like to see? I didn't quite understand. And they started peeling back the skin and the muscles like it was a banana. And, it's kind of like a little bit of a surprise to see, different body parts being taken off and moved around and peeled back. And it was kind of a very powerful experience for me to have seen that. In Southeast Asia, there's one tradition of going to, sometimes they cremate bodies, and they'll go out into the cremation grounds and spend time looking at the body as it's burning. And often, sometimes the body's all charred and they'll look at the charred body. I sent a present to an abbot in a Thai temple and monastery in Thailand and a couple of years ago. And I got a lovely kind of letter back of thanks. It's a really sweet letter of thanks. And then as a kind of a gesture of response, I guess, of appreciation and giving a gift back to me, he sent in this envelope, he sent a postcard, like you would get a card, right? And it was a card, it was a photograph of a burnt body, all black and charred and in all color. And he thought this was a really wonderful thing. And he knew I was a serious practitioner, and so he wasn't like, he probably doesn't send it to, his mother or something. But because I was a serious practitioner, he thought I'd appreciate having this for my contemplation of death. This was a normal thing you do. You contemplate death and look at it. People, especially in Thailand, who don't have easy access to charnel grounds will go, nowadays in the modern world, they'll go often to the anatomy lab or they'll go to the morgue and watch autopsies and things like that in order to really kind of be honest about this death, really see it clearly, look at it directly. And so that's a practice people do. There's also practices that people do that are not doesn't involve directly confronting a dead body, but involves thinking about death in all kinds of different ways, reflecting on it, meditating on the topic. One classic one is to sit and in meditation, get still and quiet, and then just repeat the phrase periodically, death, death, and see what bubbles up. Come back and be quiet, let go, and then do it again, see what bubbles up. Another practice is to say certain phrases around in your meditation and see what bubbles up then. Say like the phrase, death is inevitable. And you see what happens. And you say that, death is inevitable. Another practice is, which is in the Satipatthana Sutta, the manual or the description of the very practice that we, classic description of the practice we do here at our center, has within it a section which involves contemplation of a corpse. 9 different contemplations on a corpse. And it's 9 different stages of the decay of a corpse. And it's not really clear in the text whether you're actually supposed to go look at an actual corpse or whether you're supposed to imagine it. But you imagine a corpse that's just been dead and one that's beginning to bloat and fester and one that just the bones and bones are bleached and you're kind of looking at it. And it's part of this imagination, this visualization of a corpse. Then the reflection is, just as this corpse is like this, one day I will be like this. So this is going to be the fate of my body and my, you know, for me also as at some point. Now it isn't just the Buddhist tradition that does this kind of practices, reflecting and thinking about death ahead of time. I've read about Christian practices that are very similar. I don't know how similar they are, but you know, the same type. I've heard of monks, Christian monks, who will, instead of having a bed to sleep in, will have the coffin they're going to be buried in, that they sleep in every night. As a reminder, this is where they're going to end up, in this coffin. And there are monasteries in Europe where all the previous monks, their skulls and skeletons are kind of stored in this big, you know, you can go see, there's these rooms filled with their skeletons. I'm not sure why they save them like that, but certainly it adds to the fact that you can go look at that and be aware of death as something that is ever present and ever a possibility. The great Tibetan yogi Milarepa said something like the contemplation of death, the careful meditative reflection of it, is one of the ways to ensure that our spiritual practice does not remain superficial. It's also a way of maybe ensuring that our spiritual practice is honest, to really confront that which for many people is the most difficult and raises the biggest existential questions and personal questions, and to have that really come up against your psyche and your imagination and really look at that and deal with it. Some people associate spirituality with joy and bliss and peace and wonderful qualities and try to emphasize that. And that's fine. It's certainly part of a spiritual life. But part of it should also be some kind of direct confrontation with this issue of death, or it can be very helpful. So in Buddhism, we put a lot of emphasis on this. Probably not very much here in the West, in Western Buddhism. But in classic Buddhism, there's a big emphasis on this practice. Then you might ask, why? Why is this important? I've since given some reasons already, but some people will say, well, it seems kind of morbid to spend time thinking and reflecting on death. And it's not meant to be a morbid practice at all. One of the reasons to do it is to help cultivate a healthy, and I underscore the word healthy, detachment to the world and to our body. As you know, there can be tremendous preoccupation, attachment people have with their physical bodies and the life here. And to really deal with death directly and look at it and what it's all about can help, hopefully in a very healthy way, to not be so caught by these kinds of things. Many of you maybe have had some experience of being close to death or having some accident or being very sick and seeing how your priorities change from doing that. And maybe things you saw that were so important that you're so attached to vanish. Like the fellow here who had the bicycle accident. If he had petty preoccupations before his accident, before being hit by the car, they probably were kind of distant right afterwards. Probably lost much importance. And so to help with this process of letting go, looking at death can be very helpful. Here in the West, there's a tendency for people to emphasize the contemplation of death as a way of helping us to live better, to appreciate life better and to enter life more fully. And you don't find that emphasis so much in Buddhist Asia. I think it's a fine one to have. But the emphasis in Buddhism is really this process of not affirming the world so much, not negating the world either, but rather this ongoing process of finding how to live in this world without the psyche or the mind clinging to anything or resisting anything. Being very open-handed, open-minded, open-hearted. Pointing to that capacity we all have of touching what's known in Buddhism as the deathless. And so deathless dimension, which is the word up there, amata dhatu. The Buddha, when he became enlightened, it said that when he became enlightened, death lost its sting. It's also said that someone who's enlightened becomes invisible to death or to Mara. Mara is kind of the personification of death. The word Mara, which is kind of sometimes considered as the Buddhist devil, is a cognate word to our word mortal. The wonderful way in which Indo-European languages are connected to each other. And Mara is kind of comes from the Sanskrit root for to death, to die. And so someone who becomes enlightened has become freed from the sting of death, become invisible to death, to Mara. Doesn't mean the person doesn't die, but I believe it means that their psyche is no longer troubled, no longer afraid by death. Death has no hold on that person in terms of the fear that might be there. So when the Buddha was enlightened, that was part of the result of it. And as many of you know, the whole quest that the Buddha set out to resolve was this question of resolving the suffering inherent in sickness, old age, and death. He had this confrontation with sickness, old age, and death as a man who was 29 years old. Seemingly, he became 29 years old without ever seeing a corpse. And having grown up partly in the suburbs of Los Angeles, I can tell you how easy it is to grow up without seeing a corpse. I didn't even see my neighbors when they were alive. We had these electric car doors, that you push the button and they open the garage and drove in and they went directly from the garage into their house. The street was kind of like a ghost town. Really, my own first meeting of a dead body was not in America, not in the West, but was in when I was 11 years old in Kathmandu, where we were walking down the street one day and there was a little procession of a young girl who had died. And she was wrapped in a white cloth and was being carried by four people. But that was the first time I'd ever seen someone who has died was, by going to Asia, where it's very common to see, part of the culture. It's not hidden from society and from people as sometimes is here in this culture. And it's just kind of right out there and right there. If you go to Varanasi, for example, it's very easy to go sit there and watch the bodies burn. So part of one of the purposes of reflecting on death or dealing it is to help point us towards letting go of clinging, help point us to that phenomenally important teaching of impermanence, and that's liberating, and help pointing us to that possibility of the deathless dimension of our psyche, of our life. There's another reason to prepare for death, to reflect on it and think about it beforehand, and that is it helps the people around us. It's one thing for if we can be calm, if we can be at peace with our own death, I think it's a tremendous gift to the people who attend to us as we're dying. A recent retreat I was at, there was a lovely woman who I've known for many years who was dying of cancer. And she thought maybe, she didn't know how long she had, but maybe 6 months left. But the tragedy of it was that I think she has a 7 or 9 year old daughter. And that's where her great suffering was, around her own dying, was, you know, the impact this would have on our daughter. And I hope that one of the more useful things I told her as I worked with her was that as much as she was afraid of this and anxious about the impact on her daughter, that her anxiety and her fear around her death would have a big impact on her daughter. Because what it's such a huge impact on a young child, impressionable child, to have a mother or parent die. But if the mother could die at peace with her own death, you know, at least with personal peace about it, I think that's a phenomenal gift to give someone. And so one of the things we do when we prepare for death ahead of time is we're doing it for the sake of other people around us also, to help them in their own confrontation and meeting of death. I spent a lot of time, probably a couple of years, almost on a daily basis, having the reflection, what would it be like if I was going to die tonight? So I'd get up in the morning and think, what would it be like if I was going to, knew I was going to, this was my last day. And it was a fascinating contemplation to do. Very interesting to think about that and reflect on it. It was very interesting to watch how that the answer to that question changed over time. And, you know, as I changed in the process of it. And I still ask that question periodically, not as regularly as I did for those couple of years. So there's many ways of doing this kind of contemplation and this kind of practice. We'll do some of them in this Friday day that we do, that we have. So offering this class is part of that spirit of contemplation of death. Now, what I had in mind, and it might evolve as we do these 3 days, what I have in mind is to divide the 3 days in three parts. Today, to spend, to focus on this issue of preparation for death. And part of it's already talked about, to emphasize that there are a lot of these practices in Buddhism that you can do contemplating death, reflecting on death. There's not a lot of places you can go to read about it, but there's a few. And in our own Vipassana tradition, Larry Rosenberg has written a book called Living in the Light of Death. And on the art of being, he calls it the art of being truly alive. And he talks, he gives 9 different meditation practices to do here around reflective practices on this topic. And it's a very nice read. It reads well and addresses the topic quite well. So I want to talk a little bit more about preparation. Then I also want to talk a little bit about the Buddhist understanding of the process of dying. Or what happens at death, the issue of death and rebirth, as a background for these 3 days. And then next week, what I'd like to do is to talk about the dying process itself, you know, the immediacy of it, of what happens as people die and how to work with people who are dying, how to work with your own death as you're doing, how practices that are suitable at times of, you know, the last minutes, last hours, last days, and focus a little bit more at that particular juncture of time. And then perhaps in the last time, to focus a little bit more on the practices for after death, the Buddhist resources for the rituals of what to do with the body when it's died, and with people who are left behind, what they can do, the funerals, the memorial services, how to handle the body, the practices like that. And also, during that last week, I talked a little bit about the ethics, the Buddhist view of the ethics around dying. Like Allison asked about suicide, euthanasia, some of these issues that are very important for people to address around death, and they want to know what the Buddhist views are about this. So, does that sound okay? Sound okay to you, all of you? You along the program? For Buddhists, I don't want to say it this way. They, As most of you know, Buddhism has a very particular view about what happens when people die. And that is, unless you're fully enlightened, you get reborn somewhere. And there's a view that human beings, that there's been this endless cycle of birth, death, rebirth, death, rebirth, and death. And that cycle has no beginning, had no beginning. There's no first beginning, starting point for that process. It comes from beginningless time. And there's no end to this process. And in fact, the Buddhist cosmology is one of the cosmos, the universe is a Big Bang universe, so it expands and contracts endlessly. And even though the universe contracts and expands into unrecognizable forms, the process of beings dying and being reborn continues uninterruptedly, on and on and on. This view of rebirth is one that some classic Buddhists will... Some Buddhists will say, you cannot be a Buddhist without believing in it. It doesn't make any sense to be a Buddhist without believing in rebirth. And there are other Buddhist teachers who will say, that's nonsense. You don't have to believe in it. Buddhist practice isn't predicated on believing in rebirth. The Buddha once said, it's wonderful, kind of a Pascal's wager kind of thing, where the Buddha didn't seem to mind if people didn't believe in it or not. He seemed to believe in it, or know it. He was supposed to have remembered his past lives. So I guess he wouldn't say he believed in it. He would say he knew it, that rebirth is true. And but his kind of Pascal's wager version is if there is rebirth and you live accordingly, living an ethical life, a good life, then chances are you'll get a good rebirth. If there is no if there is no rebirth, but you act as if there is, then at least you'll get a lot of benefits in this life. Because there's a lot of benefits that come from living an ethical, spiritual life. So you can't lose, he said. So you should act as if it's true. And then you have Buddhist teachers who emphasize, and you find this very powerfully emphasized in the Zen tradition, that death and dying happen every moment. Not just simply that things arise and pass every moment, but in a very core way, the human being, who we are, there's a kind of a constant process of dying and then being reborn over and over again. And so the whole process of confronting death is not just something that's useful for that last moment of death, but rather it's something that's useful each moment that we're alive. Because each moment we're alive is built into this very profound movement of birth, death and rebirth, death and rebirth. So for some Buddhists, it's very reassuring to know or to believe that they're going to be reborn. Because the idea that it just everything ends, you know, with this life, for some people, is a very bleak, kind of nihilistic, and just that's what's the point of anything? And to know, this is hard or whatever, but I'm going to be reborn. This is very reassuring. For other Buddhists, it's actually quite distressing, because especially like if they hadn't lived a very good life, and they see the gates of hell is opening for them. Because Buddhists classically will believe in the possibility of being reborn in hell, the possibility of being reborn in heavenly realms as gods, the possibility of being reborn in as hungry ghosts or as animals or as a human being. And people who take this very literally true, which a lot of Buddhists do, it can be quite frightening, the tension that builds up. But I'm not sure where I'm going to go, and do I really want to be burned in hell for the next 10 million years. The good news in Buddhism is that the classic view of hells and heavens and all that is that they're always temporary. the fact that you've been reborn in hell or reborn in heaven, in heavenly realms, doesn't mean the process of death and rebirth doesn't continue. It's just that your lifespan has become very long in those states. But sooner or later, you die from those states and get reborn. So for some Buddhists, it's very reassuring. For some Buddhists, it's very distressing, the idea of rebirth. For some Buddhists, they take it very seriously, the possibility of rebirth. And their spiritual practice, their Buddhist practice itself, is predicated on a strategy of how to work with this endless cycles of rebirth, to optimize it, to work with it, to make it to work in their favor. So, for example, they'll practice a lot of merit making, because living an ethical, virtuous life and performing merits is one way of creating the proper spin so that the being is reborn in beneficial states. Some Buddhists in Thailand and Sri Lanka and different places, Mahayana also, have the strategy of trying to being reborn in certain very ideal places, certain heavenly realms, or in the presence of certain kind of Buddhas or Buddhas to be, so they can peacefully wait for the arrival of the next Buddha. See, there's a few because the world expands and contracts, things are going to get a lot worse before they get better. Things get worse and they get better and they get worse and get better. And it's a kind of to spend endless lifetime, getting reborn over and over again in the cycle of the universe getting worse and then better and worse and better. It's kind of a drag. And so they strategize, they do practices to try to help them get reborn in particular heavens that are kind of exempt from this process, where you have this really, really long lifetime, where you can kind of peacefully live in this blissful state. And then you can finally kind of get reborn, die in that state and get reborn at a time when a future Buddha will be here, which is one of the best times to be reborn, because then you can get, it's most easy to get fully enlightened in the presence of a Buddha. So these are a lot of the traditional beliefs that exists. There's a lot of people who believe these things. They're very important for people. I'm not going to knock them for anyone. But I want you to know that this is kind of in the background of classic Buddhism. There's different variations on it in different Buddhist traditions. What happens at the moment of death? There are different, even though there's some commonality in the different schools of Buddhism, there's also a great diversity. And in fact, some people have pointed out there's greater diversity among the different schools of Buddhism than there is between all the different types of Christianity. And there's a great diversity in Christianity too. But even more. And one of the reasons perhaps for the greater diversity in Buddhism is that Buddhism does not have a central Bible or central Pope around which all the traditions kind of orient themselves somewhat. So that as Buddhism has evolved, for example, traditions have created their own, or whole new scriptures have evolved and developed, and old ones have been forgotten. So like the scriptures that the Theravada tradition is centered around have basically been forgotten or ignored by the Tibetan tradition, for example. They just didn't bother translating those, or they didn't translate them. So that the Satipatthana Sutta, for example, which is a discourse that our practice is based on, was not known in Tibet until very recently, I think the last century, when they went to Sri Lanka or Thailand and learned about it from there. So there's great diversity in the Buddhist tradition, and there's diversity of view about what happens at the moment of death. And what people are most commonly aware of in the West are the Tibetan views about it. And there's a number of reasons for that. One reason is that the Tibetan book of dying, is what it's called? Tibetan Book of the Dead, right, was translated in the 1920s. Had a huge impact on the Western psyche, and had a big impact, of course, on the hippies, who were our forefathers in creating the Western Buddhist movement. Some are sitting here in this room, I'm sure. And if you bow to our... And also, the Tibetan tradition has I think has a, in some ways a greater emphasis on the importance of the process of dying than other Buddhist traditions. They have elaborate texts like the Tibetan Book of the Dead that talk about this elaborate process that resonated very much with psychedelic experience for people. So it kind of got people's attention and imagination going quite strongly. And they could well be right, the Tibetans, who knows. But the Theravada tradition has a very different view about what happens at the moment of death. But as Cheryl pointed out, she has never heard me talk about death and dying. And Western teachers, Vipassana teachers, don't talk about this very much. And so people who have embraced this practice here in the West, who are looking to understand Buddhist views of death and dying, don't see it, you know, until Larry's book was published, don't see any resources in our tradition. So they do the obvious thing, which is they have all these wonderful books coming up, being published by the Tibetan teachers. And so they go there to understand it. And there's no problem with that, I think, particularly. However, it is a little bit sad not to know at least what those resources are in their own tradition. And to know that actually the understanding is different. The understanding in the... and then there's always this... Is this interesting you enough? Sometimes I go on and on, you know. It's kind of, you know, while you're here, for me to do a monologue. It's dangerous to do monologues. If you do it at parties, you get in trouble. But it's okay here, I guess. I do sometimes get self-conscious. Yes? I believe, in my impression, having read different things by Stephen Levine, that he is kind of an agnostic about what happens when you die. He's really focused his life on that process of dying and helping people in that process. But what happens after you've died? I think he's kind of, you know, he's quite open to tremendous mystery being there. I don't know, but I've heard him. I read once where he said, "You know, I don't know." And so his emphasis has been kind of the mindfulness of the mindfulness and the process of healing that can happen in as we go through the death process itself, dying process, and not what happens afterwards. So in that sense, he hasn't borrowed from the metaphysics, the cosmology, of the Buddhist tradition that much. What he's borrowed is these practices that really focus on the mindfulness practice, which is very important for him, that he brought to the whole work of hospice work that he did. And that's been an emphasis, you know, of our kind of Western Vipassana tradition that we're part of, is for the most part to leave behind, not be so interested in the metaphysics or the cosmology and all that, and not talk about it so much. And I'm mostly content not to talk about it. I'm content to focus on the process of practice in this life. But I thought in doing this class, that it would be very hard or it seemed inappropriate not to talk briefly about the classic Buddhist view of what happens there. Because people want to know. And it's a big question, a big existential question. Yes?
What about the Tibetan Book of Living and Dying?
Well, that's a modern book written by a modern teacher and his Western assistants. I think some of it was penned by Andrew Harvey. Is that Andrew Harvey? Andrew Harvey. And he's kind of a poet person. I read the book. It's a great book. You know, I thought it was very helpful. But again, it's the Tibetan view of what happens in that process. And the Theravadins don't exactly share that view. It's a different view. So the big difference is that in the Tibetan view, there's an intermediate period between the time a person dies and the time that they're reborn. And that intermediate period can be very short, or it can be as long as 49 days. Now, I don't know this tradition that well, so I can't represent it that well. But intermediate period is a very important period because there's various opportunities there, various bardos, various kind of gaps or transition periods, where it's relatively easy to get liberated. And so to be prepared for this transition period, to have guides who stay with a body for the first couple of days, reading the Tibetan Book of the Dead or guiding it, to encourage the psyche before to take advantage of the possibility inherent in this intermediate stage. And it said there's, right after death is the most opportune time if you know what to do. But then there's all these, the mind conjures up these, can conjure up very frightening images. So you have to learn how to work with the frightening images so you don't get caught by them. Because if you are, then that'll spin you back to be reborn. The Theravadin view is that rebirth happens pretty much instantaneously, pretty much quickly. Sometimes there's the idea that you hear Theravadin teachers say that the being will kind of hover, consciousness will kind of hover for a while around the body and the corpse. But basically, there's no emphasis on intermediate period. Often it's pretty instantaneous that the being gets reborn. Yes?
Would it be appropriate, that might not be, for you to say a few words about the relationship between the entity that dies and the entity that's reborn?
Yeah. The entity that dies. So, so in the Theravadin tradition, the idea is that it's pretty instantaneous. So sometimes the consciousness can kind of hover for a while, be around for a while, and you can kind of get a sense, some people have a sense, very strong sense, that the person's still there somehow, in the room or in the air, or somehow there's a presence, and there's a kind of sense or feeling, qualitative feeling that people have that, oh, now it's really gone. That's sometime after the last breath. But so there isn't, in the Theravadin tradition, there are not these resources or the technology for working with the intermediate bardo period, this transition period. As this is that there's an opportunity here for liberation in the same way as it is in Tibetan tradition. So maybe it's a poor tradition because of it, or maybe it's just different, or, you know. I must say that I am also an agnostic around all this. I really don't know. Sometimes I'm a sympathetic agnostic to the Buddhist view, and sometimes it makes a lot of sense to me. And sometimes I'm not so sympathetic agnostic. It doesn't make so much sense. But I'm, in either case, I'm an agnostic. And my own view about the my own view is that it's not really necessary to have a view about what happens when you die. Though that's counter to what some other Buddhist teachers feel very strongly. They think I'm heretical to say that. So you have to sort your own way through this. And I apologize for any confusion I cause people from my own ignorance about this topic. But I do the best I can. The Buddha was once asked, what happens, what is it that gets reborn? And it's very interesting, the Buddha basically said this is an inappropriate question. The Buddha said this is not a question you want to ask. It can't be, you're not going to say something is, so there is something that gets reborn, or there's something that does, that there is nothing that gets reborn. There's no thing which is in the process. One way of understanding this, which is probably not the tradition uses it itself sometimes, but is the process of rebirth is a process of, it's similar to how waves move across the ocean. It looks like from a distance that the particular wave is moving through the ocean. You can kind of track and you point to it. But if you know the physics of waves, there's no thing which is moving across the ocean. There's no entity. It's a pattern that's moving across. And you can point to that pattern. It's the you know, water molecule goes up and down, vibrates up and down, and it strikes a molecule next to it, and that goes up and down. And so there's no thing which is moving across, but rather this you know, vibration thing. It's kind of like, you know, in sports theaters nowadays, people do the wave. Is anything moving across the Colosseum? There's no thing which is moving, right? No thing. It just is kind of this, I don't know if you could say energy, but it looks like movement. You know, something's moving. So at the moment of death, the consciousness at the moment of death has a spin to it. And that part of that spin is desire or clinging. And there's various things which feed into that spin. And your wholesome habits that you have built up, or your wholesome activities, your karma, your intentions, put a certain spin on that. And your unwholesome, your unhealthy, unethical things put a certain spin on that. And the balance of that spin, or various ways, who knows how the arithmetic works out. But somehow that spin that consciousness has at the moment of death in a sense strikes a consciousness somewhere else that's arisen somewhere else and then passes on that spin. It's not an adequate explanation of the Buddhist view, but it's probably closer than anything else. The Buddha actually didn't explain this. So we're kind of left without the Buddha as an authority for what actually goes on. However, Chungyong Trungpa was once asked, what is it that gets reborn? And his answer was, your bad habits. And in the Theravadan view, I think the more appropriate answer is it's just your habits, good or bad. So even if you have cultivated a lot of good habits, you're still moving in the cycles of rebirth. The goal in classic Buddhism is to stop the cycles of rebirth. So to get out of that cycle. And the ultimate peace, the ultimate happiness, is not found in the cycles of rebirth. Because even if you manage to get reborn for 100 million years as a god, blissful states, that's in the big scheme of time, that's just a blink of the eye. And that's not such a big deal. And the real thing you want to do is to step off the wheel. So both our good and bad habits keep us on the wheel. And it's not a habit, it's not our deeds that get us enlightened, but it's this transformation of consciousness that somehow touches the unconditioned. Relates to the unconditioned. Let's go entirely. It's a process of letting go. So what happens at... So then depending on... So the moment of death then is very important because the shape, the spin on the consciousness at the moment of death affects how that spin strikes the next consciousness when it takes birth again. And so in the Theravadan tradition, there's a lot of emphasis then put on trying to have the best possible state of mind at the moment of death to optimize that process of rebirth. And we'll talk more about that later. When the Theravadan teachers have been asked about to reconcile their view of what happens at death with the Tibetan view, where there's this long intermediate period. What I've heard them say is that they're basically saying the Tibetans are a little bit confused. Who knows who's confused? I don't know. And what they say is that what's happened is that the person is not in an intermediate state. But the person has been reborn as a preta, a hungry ghost. And a hungry ghosts are these beings that it's kind of an intermediate stage. It's kind of like ghosts. They're kind of hungry ghosts are still very closely connected to this world, the world we live in, and very closely connected to the place that they died and the people that they loved And so there can still be a relationship there. And so what's happening, they say, in the Tibetan tradition is they're relating to the hungry ghosts in their states. And that state can be 49 days. It can be 3 days. It can be various times. And that's what they've tuned into. I don't know. I'm very impressed by some of the descriptions I've seen in the Tibetan view of what happens. And it seems to correlate very well with some of the experiences that some people have in near-death experiences. And it also correlates well with some of the experiences people can have in very deep meditation, where letting go in very, very deep places in the psyche brings some of the same kind of experiences along. My own kind of opinion, belief, my opinion, I don't have any good evidence for this, is that the process of meditation, the deep process of meditation, the very deepest experience of meditation, the process of letting go of meditation, is very, very closely akin to the process of letting go that happens as a person dies. So, now does it happen over 49 days, or does it happen, you know, over 49 seconds? Or does, you know, time becomes maybe kind of a relative thing, right? And at the dying moments. People have had reviewed their whole lives, sometimes in a, you know, fraction of a second when they thought they were going to die. And so, you know, time kind of changes its meaning somehow at those times. So it could be that maybe both traditions are kind of right, that the Tibetan tradition describes a process that, but just much more truncated. And that there's a real opportunity in that process. I don't know. So that's kind of, you have to sort your way through this. I apologize that I don't know better. I wish I did. Because some people would expect from a Buddhist teacher a lot more clarity, so then they get to their deathbed, they can get a clear answer and have the peace of certainty. Yes?
It seems like what you're actually going to do is just die.
Me?
Yeah.
I don't know what's going to do.
Yeah, that's what you keep saying. I don't know.
Yeah, I'm sorry. I think about it. I take it very seriously, the process of dying. I see the process of dying for myself as being a very important opportunity. From what things I've learned from meditation, if I'm lucky in the process of death, if it's slow enough or something, then I anticipate it'll be very comparable. It might be very different. I don't know. I mean, I kind of have this faith, this belief that probably be very similar, and that what I've learned in the process of meditation will be very useful for me in the letting go process that will probably be there as I'm dying. So it probably has to be the similar letting go of, you know, you have to let go of so much when you're dying, including your ego, and to have gone through a process of letting go in meditation, and the kind of rarefied states in meditation that can come from letting go. So I'm very keen, I'm very interested in this process, and have a very
So your intention is to kind of bury the mind.
Bury the mind?
Bury this meditative process.
Bear it in mind. Oh, sorry. I still have a cold. Sickness, old age, and death is always present. So bear it in mind. My hope for my dying process is I can continue practicing mindfulness. Mindfulness is considered in the Theravada tradition the best preparation for dying. And if you're able to practice mindfulness, because again, there's a kind of sense, there's no intermediate stage in Theravada, you know, after death to work with. But that process of dying itself does offer an opportunity for deep practice for liberation. And one of the best things you can do for your psyche is this practice of mindfulness itself. So if you have that under your belt, if you have strength and develop that when you still can, then hopefully you can use that in the process of dying. So bearing in mind means I'm hoping that I can practice in that process, if that's what is my, you know, my destiny.
Well, it is usually the most important thing and the most obvious thought that one has it when has an illness like cancer is a benefit. Of course, what the emphasis is on, I'm dying, you know, now. You know, it's kind of like everything else kind of falls away, you know, the career, the appearance, you know, and whether I have my shirt buttoned or my pants unzipped or my shoes on or whatever. I just kind of you can really concentrate, really have your own undivided attention. You know, at that time, yeah.
I hope so.
Yeah, that's really cool.
You know, I keep thinking, as I think about this subject, and I have for, you know, probably an unhealthy amount of time, because I used to think about it as a child, that a very large, from my experience, and a fairly large percentage of us are not going to have, this is not going to be available, that our minds will go before we die. We will develop some level of senility, full-on Alzheimer's, stroke. There's any vast numbers of ways that the clarity of mind will not be present for us. And these seem to be mere accidents of fate. And therefore, given a perfect situation, it's kind of like the old Indian chiefs in the stories and the movies. It's time to die, so you sit down and you enter the state, and very much like the Buddha did, the story of the Buddha, which is that he goes through all of these various levels of meditation and finally comes back up to a level before he actually dies. This will be available to us because we won't be present anymore.
There's a lot of mystery about what happens. So you're making some conclusions about what the process, even in process, in coma or senility, some conclusions about what is or is not available. There's a kind of cliche in the death and dying industry work where that people die in character. And how I interpret that is that the habits, the dispositions that we've cultivated and acted on in our life often carry along with us into even dementia or Alzheimer's. And if you've managed to resolve some of your issues, some of your attachments, some of your clinging, some of your fears earlier on, then perhaps some of those things will pass away. Won't be there to plague you at times of you're more incapacitated. I don't know if that's true or not, but it's a nice operating principle. So it seems there's lots of experiences of seemingly making big difference speaking to people in comas and kind of helping them in their process, where they seem to be able to listen and process things in a way that doesn't seem to be the normal cognitive mind, perhaps. I don't know what happens when we're incapacitated in various ways, but I'd like to practice and operate now as if I can make a difference. It's kind of like the Pascal wager kind of thing, right?
And something that occurred to me while this gentleman was speaking is that what you're talking about and what you two were talking about is a great argument for arriving at a place where you are present all the time. Because if you are present all the time and you're run over by a truck and you are there and present for your death, and you don't have to worry about whether you have time to think about it or not.
Right. And let's see. So, Stephen, your question again was? Did I answer it, or do you want to ask it again?
I think you answered it very well.
Oh, okay.
About the relationship.
Okay.
From
So there are two strategies that when you take the classic Buddhist view of what happens with death and rebirth, there are two very general strategies that Buddhists will have. One is to focus on liberation, and the other is to focus on creating the conditions for a good rebirth. And the process of how you emphasize, how you help someone in the process of dying depends which of those two you're trying to help a person do. And for most, in Thailand, for example, for most lay people who don't have a practice background, when the monk comes along to minister someone who's dying, what the classic thing they do is they're not trying to help them become liberated, but they're trying to condition the consciousness and create merit, create good deeds and stuff, to so that they get reborn into more optimal conditions. So other questions? Yes.
A few years ago, I was in a group with a relatively small audience with the Dalai Lama. And he was asked that exact question. Do you think that your life and your practice will help you when you're dying? He paused and he smiled and he said, we'll see.
Smita.
I have a theoretical question, and maybe it's useful or maybe it's not. But I sometimes struggle with, given the Buddhist way of rebirth, of thinking about rebirth, if nothing is reborn, no particular thing is reborn, there's no soul that's passing, it's very useful because I'm stuck in the Hindu tradition still a little bit. But then what gets liberated?
I think that the whole question of what is kind of not something. There's a lot of really good questions that normal, obvious questions to ask. That the Buddha kind of said, "You don't bother with these kinds of questions. They're not necessary for the process of liberation." But what gets liberated? One way of saying that is that what gets liberated is our clinging. Is that not enough? You look very unsatisfied.
I appreciate what you said. I just wonder if there isn't somebody who has taken a view, kind of a larger connected view. If there's our, maybe I shouldn't say anything, because it sounds so silly.
Probably your question is going to be very good, and there's a lot of very deep existential questions about identity and that come into play around all this, and certainly a lot of Buddhists have tried to make various answers and offer resources for it. And for myself, I've been very inspired by the historical Buddha, where he was actually, there's so many of these existential questions which he pointed out as being not useful to, spiritually useful to address. More important things to do. Spiritual practice is more important than certain kinds of questions and answers. And certain kind of questions don't lend themselves to useful answers. So just avoid those kinds of questions. But it's an obvious thing to ask because we want, you know, the idea of personal continuity, and it's very reassuring for some people, and they would like to know how it works, and if it really happens.
Made sense of it for myself is that it's not me who's going to be reborn in a particular way, and it's not me who, God willing, whoever willing, one day may be liberated, but the reason I'm doing what I'm doing is that something gets reborn in a better, there's a good birth, that's a reason to practice, and there's a liberation, one more liberated soul, and that's a good reason to practice. It may not have anything to do with me, myself as such. But in a sense, if we are all connected, those are good enough reasons for me to.
Great. Yes, please.
I was wondering what the difference is in the Theravada tradition between preparing for rebirth and preparing for liberation. What would be
Preparing for liberation is mindfulness practice is understood to be the key for liberation, and so doing mindfulness practice, vipassana practice directly, or doing supportive practices for that in preparation for doing vipassana, for doing better rebirth kind of practices. Certainly, mindfulness also helps create a better rebirth, so you kind of do both at the same time if you'd like, but. Concentration practices, rather than mindfulness practices, tend to be the ones who, in terms of meditation practice, that are conducive to a good rebirth. If you can get into really deep states of concentration to the jhanas, for example, on a regular basis, doing loving kindness practice, for example. There's also practices of reflecting on the qualities of a Buddha, reflecting on your own good deeds, reflecting on things that kind of brighten up the mind and make it happy and delighted. It's often your actions which have a big impact on how you're reborn. So there's practices of generating merit, doing good deeds, and living a virtuous life. And so you find Buddhists all over the world will spend a lot of time making donations or doing good deeds or helping the poor or various things. Not just because it's a humanistic thing to do, it's helpful to people to do, because it's a way of generating merit for themselves. And then they either use that merit for their own rebirth, or they'll take that merit and they'll give it to their dead parents. It's very common in Thailand for people, like, for example, to go off and become ordained as a monk for a while, for a couple of years or some period of time. You produce a lot of merit by being a monk or a nun. And then you take that merit and you dedicate it to your parents to help them out, to return the debt you owe them. Does that answer your question? No, there's a big overlap, or they're mutually supportive of each other, so that in order to do the more liberating practices, it's very helpful to have a foundation of strong ethics and virtue, and to have the good feel good about yourself, to have a lot of good merit behind you, and to develop these good qualities and gladden the mind through good works and to practice compassion and all these things. That's also very supportive, creates a foundation for that. And also practicing mindfulness is very helpful for the kind of practice that produces good works. It has to that produces good merit. It probably depends a little bit on which you're emphasizing, you know, or what's the purpose of what you're doing. If your purpose is to get reborn in the optimal world, optimal rebirth, then you want to choose certain kind of practices predominantly. It's the predominant direction of your mind, predominant channels and activities of the mind over a lifetime, or the ones that kind of follow you into the moment of death, that have put the biggest spin on where you're going to get reborn. So if you spent a lifetime being very virtuous, you've been completely virtuous, you never harmed any being at all, and you know, then that's a very powerful momentum in psyche. So we're getting reborn in those kind of heavenly realms that virtuous people get reborn in.
So what would be the purpose of getting reborn as opposed to being liberated from the cycle? And what would be the purpose of being liberated from the cycle rather than reborn? Am I asking?
No, those are fine questions. I'll try to be brief because it is running kind of late now. Classically, liberation has no purpose beyond itself. However, in the West, we often will talk about, well, once you're liberated, then you can be of greater service to people. You have greater compassion, and you can work with, you know, you can be more of service, because we have such a strong emphasis in the West on service. And it's probably true that's the case, but. Classically, liberation has no purpose beyond itself. Why would a person want to get reborn? There's a number of reasons. Some people feel they have no choice, because it takes a lot of intense spiritual practice to take the practice far enough to get liberated enough to no longer be on the wheel of. So they feel that, you know, they're not going to do that level of practice. So, okay, since I can't do that level of practice, at least I'll do the kind of things I can do to give myself a better rebirth next life. Maybe next life I can be a monastic. Maybe next time, you know, something. That's one reason, you know. And another reason is that people have certain strategies. where they need to be reborn a number of times to fulfill those strategies. And the Mahayana path of the Bodhisattva is one such strategy. The Bodhisattva path requires many lifetimes of spiritual preparation. And there's a vows part of the Bodhisattva path that involves vowing to come back in order to help people. So people will come back in order to fulfill certain practices they couldn't do this lifetime, or in order to be of service to other people. Sometimes people will focus on certain rebirths because part of the strategy is to be reborn at the time of Maitreya Buddha, the next Buddha. And so they want to get fully liberated, but they want to do it in the presence of the next Buddha. So, okay, let's just figure out a way to get reborn appropriately for a few billion years, million years, until this next guy comes along. So there's strategies people have in negotiating the cycles of rebirth. So this is all part of classic Buddhism. I think that a lot of the people, I've always assumed that a lot of people practicing Vipassana in the West are not that keenly interested in this. It's not that relevant to the cosmology, the mythology, the worldview, the metaphysics of this is not that important for their engagement in practice. For some people, it is very important. Now, the resources for that kind of understanding are in the tradition. For some people, it's very motivating and very important to understand it. And for other people, there's much more of a this life kind of focus of the practice, and kind of a focus on not adopting beliefs and views that they have no way of verifying for themselves. And so they feel, well, that's fine for those Buddhists who want to believe those things, but since I can't believe them because I don't have access to the evidence, I'm very content for the resources that Buddhism has to offer for the practices of this lifetime right here. So I hope that was an adequate job, and I hope it was appropriate enough for this context to kind of lay that in the background for what you're doing. I don't think we'll talk too much more about this kind of angle on this topic. There'll be a little bit we'll talk about it as we go along, but this is not going to be the main thrust of it. What I didn't have time to talk about today, which I wanted to spend a chunk of time talking about, is a whole other level of preparation work that can be done besides practice, Buddhist practices for preparation. And that are the logistical preparations that I encourage people to do, and the kind of thing that Kate was very interested in doing. Maybe next week I'll talk more about that. But there's really important things you can do, both for your sake and for the sake of others, that some people talked nicely about earlier. There's various kinds of documents you can write about your wishes, about what kind of medical care you get when things get kind of serious, or you don't have the capacity to talk for yourself. Who can sign and make decisions for you? The power of durable attorney and things like that. It's very helpful to plan. It can be very helpful with the people you leave behind if you tell them what you'd like to do in terms of a funeral, memorial service to your body. I've attended to some people's death where I've been around them. Where I remember one where this woman. Was kind of a closet Buddhist. She'd been involved very many years with a Buddhist group, was very intensely involved in it, it was very primary for her. But she kind of more or less kept it away from her family, and they were Christian of some denomination. And all her closest friends were Buddhists, and they knew how important Buddhism was and how much she would have wanted to have a Buddhist memorial service and a Buddhist teacher there to do it. But she never told her family that. And so they didn't really understand the depth of how important Buddhism was for her. And so they just brought her to the Christian church that the family was part of and did Christian memorial service for her. And it was probably lovely, but at least her friends felt that something was amiss there because she hadn't told anybody about what her wishes were. And also, a lot of people don't know what to do. I think a lot of people, there's a fair number of people I've helped in our extended community who don't have a really grounded, aren't anymore in a, maybe the religion of their birth, or maybe they never had a strong religious tradition. So they don't have the resources that come with their own church or their own synagogue or temple. And so they're kind of haven't really been that religious in many ways. And so they come to the Buddhist tradition here and they're practicing and it's very important for them. But they never really thought about it much, about what, what kind of memorial service they want. And so the loved ones who are left behind, they know they're kind of Buddhist and Buddhist practice, but they don't know quite what to do. The person will be cremated or buried. The person will be thrown to the birds. So all kinds of options that are available, at least in some cultures. So to plan ahead with that, what are your wishes for memorial service? What are your wishes for what you do with your body? To write these things out. So I was going to cover a little bit more of that, and maybe I can talk more about that next week. Bring some documents for you that you could maybe find useful. So I hope this has been useful. I must admit that I usually feel a little bit tentative about this kind of teaching when I just teach in what I think is information, on and on and on. I feel I'm not so sure how useful it is, but. So we'll see how it goes. But next week will certainly be quite different. And I very appreciate that so many people were interested in looking this issue more head-on than we usually do. So have a wonderful week, thank you.